Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And there will be no frivolity because we only have Claire Lopez on for an hour. Darn it.
Doesn't mean we can't frivol while she's on.
Yeah, true. We'll frivol after.
There will be some frivol.
So just for those folks who don't know who Claire is, then you haven't been listening. So, of course, that kind of gives you away. But she is the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy, a senior fellow at the London Center for Policy Research, and a member of the Board of Advisors for the Canadian McKinsey Institute. And she's got a lot more credential behind that. But she is a big-time expert on the Middle East, specifically Iran and Syria. She has written a book called The Rise of the Iran Lobby and just has a lot of on-the-ground information about that whole thing. So she usually is on with other guests that we have on regularly, and we always have audio problems and auditory problems and problems, and so this time it's just Claire. So we will be listening while Claire tells us stuff. Good afternoon, Claire.
Hi, Claire.
Hi. Nice to be with you.
Thanks a bunch. Where would you like to take us today?
Well, I'll be guided by you.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a whole heck of a lot going on
exactly.
Over this embassy move. What can you tell us about that?
President Trump, of course, during the presidential campaign, made a promise that he would move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which the Israelis have declared is their capital and which has been the capital of the Jewish people for over 3,000 years and never has been the capital of any other people in that time. And he made good on that promise just a few days ago. And announced that the U.S. would be moving our embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And I gather they're going to build a brand new big embassy, which will take some time, but that is coming. In the meantime, you know, there's the usual stomping up and down from all the upset Muslims and Arabs, but the Israelis, of course, were prepared for that.
Now, just for those folks that don't know, this was actually voted on in the Senate in, 1995?
Yeah, and Congress passed? Actually voted on this.
Yeah, we voted.
So this isn't shocking.
This,
I mean, this wasn't a new idea, right?
No, that's right. It has been law for all of these years, but what happened is that each president, each time, signed a waiver delaying the move. And finally, President Trump said, no more delays. This is it.
So this wasn't something he did because the left is portraying this like some sort of unilateral thing. This has actually been a law on the books for a long time.
Yes, indeed it has. Mm-hmm.
How bizarre. Okay.
Now, why are they so upset? I mean, because our embassy... Is it because now we officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital, whereas before maybe we didn't?
Yes, in a way. Of course, you know, the leftover Arabs of the Levant who didn't get taken up into any of the other brand new countries that were created during the 20th century, like Jordan or Iraq or Syria, they wanted to have their own another country for Arab Muslims, yet another one, and they decided that they just wanted Jerusalem. That's what they wanted.
Oh, okay.
No reason for it. There's no Palestinian people, never have been. They've never had a country, never had a capital. Jerusalem has never been their capital, but under the Islamic traditions, there is a story, totally apocryphal, of course, that Muhammad, at some point during the night, dreaming down on the Arabian Peninsula, traveled by a magic, I don't know, winged horse, or maybe it was a magic carpet, I'm not sure, to Jerusalem, and from there ascended up into heaven, where he met God and Moses and Noah and Adam and many other figures of the Old Testament. And based on that that story, Muslims have laid claim to Jerusalem. A second claim by Muslims comes from the fact that in the first a few years after it is said that Muhammad died, that is, if he ever actually lived. We're not sure about that. There's no evidence. But if he did, in the year 637, I think, in that area, Muslim armies conquered Jerusalem. And there is doctrine within Islam that says any land ever conquered or occupied by the forces of Islam is forever waqf, that's W-A-Q-F, land endowed by Allah to Muslims. And if they lose it or lose control of it, they have to fight till the end of time to get it back again. So there's that.
Okay.
Another
and,
good reason to fight till the end of time. What the heck? Any excuse is a good one. Yeah. God.
So that's why
that's why the big
that's
outrage.
Why they're all outraged is because it's been written that it's Muslim land.
Well, they're like 2 year olds that want something. They want the cookie before the dinner, and they don't get the cookie before the dinner, so they scream and holler and jump up and down, and this is what they're doing.
Now we're not hearing a lot, at least I haven't, on the news on cable news or what have you, about the uprising. Is there a lot going on over there, or is it just a few outbreaks?
There have been protests in the Jerusalem areas. Unfortunately, people have actually been injured and killed. But elsewhere in the world, it has been here and there. There have been protests in some other places, like Indonesia and I guess some other places, but perhaps not, you know, Lebanon's another one, not as much of an uprising or not as much of an outbreak as might have been feared.
Now, Claire, you've been around that area a lot, and you have a vast experience with the region. Is this move something we should have done, in your opinion, or should we have just passed it on to the next guy like everybody else has done?
Well, no. I mean, every country in the world gets to say what is its capital. And it was only Israel that, for some reason, was not permitted to say Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. The eternal and united Jerusalem, the capital of the Jewish people, as I said, for something like 3,000 years, going back in the Bible and the Old Testament to a long time ago, and for some reason we didn't accord them that respect to choose their own capital.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we have corrected that. Thank you, President Donald Trump.
Who else has embassies in Jerusalem?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
No, just I haven't.
I'm just curious if other nations have made this move and not received the flack that the United States is getting for doing.
Well, and of course, the whole big thing is it'll set back Middle East peace like we've ever had.
Yeah,
like there's ever been any.
We're going to set that back again. Oh, yeah, we were on the cusp.
We were right there.
Yeah,
and then,
we were right there.
And then we walked away.
Condos.
Yeah, ooh. I mean it's really rather silly because again, the conflict between Muslims and Israel and Jews is canonical. It is part of Islamic doctrine. That's not going away anytime soon. It's not about this piece of land, that piece of land, this corner of Jerusalem, or that. It is about the right of Israel exist as the nation of the Jewish people. That's what it's about, and that's what they deny. Because Islamic doctrine obligates Islam, Muslims, to deny that to Jews.
Hmm. So, again, thank you, President Trump.
Yes, in fact, for sure.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And you know, once I realized that they had, I didn't know, they had passed a law back in 1995 to move the embassy, I thought, gotta be kidding, all this stuff is just fake outrage, actually, yet again. Okay, we can go one of two ways, and totally your choice. I was curious, you had co-authored a piece called Sharia, the Threat to America, and then the global, and then you have several on the global jihad movement. And I know that's really in your wheelhouse. Can you give us an update on where we are with this crazy global jihad thing?
Well, the Center for Security Policy, of course, focuses quite a bit on, as our name might suggest, threats to U.S. national security. And key among them, of course, is the global Islamic movement or Islamic jihad, which, of course, doesn't just affect us, but so many other places around the world. And so in 2010, we published a composite book, I guess you might say, that is a collection of chapters by a total of some 19 different authors and writers, including in the foreword and the preface to the book. And I had the privilege of being able to edit that book as well as to write some parts of it. This under the leadership of Frank Gaffney, the president of the Center for Security Policy, which, by the way, we are going to celebrate our 30th anniversary next year. That is, for 30 years,
wow.
Frank Gaffney has led the Center for Security Policy website, by the way, for that. And to keep up on all of our doings as well as our publications is centerforsecuritypolicy.org. And there you may see all of the books and monographs that we have published over the last several years. Most of them, if not all of them, are available at the website as a free PDF download. But if you'd rather have a hard copy, they are published in paperback and are available at Amazon for very nominal amounts, anywhere from $6 to, I guess, about $11 or $12, depending on the size of the book. But certainly that first one, Sharia, the Threat to America, plus an abridged version available at the website. We know that the original is a hefty read, and so we did put out an abridged version of that. So those at the website and Amazon. And then we have two series, as you kind of alluded to, two series of books. And one is called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. And that one is a series of books about the non-kinetic, the non-violent jihad. So many people, I think, have a tendency to equate the jihad that we face simply and only with violence, like Al-Qaeda or Hamas or Islamic State, and those are certainly dangerous to be sure, and threats to U.S. national security. But we and others also think that much, much, much more dangerous than any violent jihad or terrorism is subversion. And here in the United States, the in the vanguard of the Islamic movement, as Muslims call it the Islamic movement, in the vanguard is the Muslim Brotherhood, founded, of course, in Egypt back in 1928, but jumped the pond, as it were, and arrived in the United States sometime not that long after World War II, been here ever since, and infiltrating, co-opting, and subverting what I like to call the key pillars of support of American society. And so we have a Civilization Jihad Reader Series to document that. And among that series of monographs, we have some of the following. Sharia in American courts. Yes, Sharia, Islamic law, is already present in some form in American courts, and we wrote a book plus a previous study as well about that. We have Ann Corcoran's very popular Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra to America, about how Muslims, following the example of Muhammad, who moved from Mecca to Medina, well, at least they say he did, this is according to the stories they tell, back in the year 622, and once having made that move, that Hijra migration, launched into the violent jihad and the rest of the violent conquest by the Muslim armies. Then a companion book to Ann Corcoran's Refugee Resettlement is something we called The Red-Green Axis by Jim Simpson, who's a terrific writer and analyst, and he documented more about the various groups, the nonprofits or non-governmental organizations that are involved in the U.S. refugee resettlement program for enormous amounts of profit. Debbie Weiss, superb writer as well, and really premier expert in the United States.
Hello?
There we are. Did we lose you?
Sounded like something bad just happened.
I think your cat stepped on the phone.
I'm not sure there, but okay. So Debbie Weiss's book is called The Organization of Islamic Cooperations, Jihad on Free Speech. And that is a topic she is just so good on. And she wrote that one to show how the OIC, that is the 57-member head of state organization of all Muslim countries in the world, biggest such group in the world after the United Nations itself. And the OIC, of course, is most notorious for having pulled every single Muslim government in the world out of the United Nations Universal Declaration on Human Rights back in 1990 with the Cairo Declaration, and instead declared that Muslim countries would consider human rights only those granted under Sharia, Islamic law. So Debbie writes about that. Star Spangled Sharia is another one I'd like to point out, which is a really excellent book. We published that one in 2015, I think. And it is the story of the creation of the USCMO. You asked where we are with this today. This is the book about that. USCMO stands for United States Council of Muslim Organizations. And it is an organization of organizations, if you will, an umbrella group for all the Muslim Brotherhood groups in the United States. It's led by CAIR, C-A-I-R, Council on American Islamic Relations, which, of course, was founded by the top three Hamas officials in the United States at the time, back in 1993. One of those remains executive director to this day, Nihad Awad. But others have joined the USCMO, including ICNA, Islamic Circle of North America, and so many more. So that is the story of the Brotherhood's first real political party in the United States. That's what that is.
And yet they would like to tell us that, oh, they're not there at all, but we know they got a huge foothold over the last, you know, 8 years.
It's front groups. They do it through front groups. They don't admit that the Brotherhood is here or Hamas is here, but it is.
Right.
Simply go by different front groups. And we know this. We have the evidence for this because of a trial that took place in Texas in 2008. It concluded in 2008. And it's called the Holy Land Foundation trial. The Holy Land Foundation was a purported charity, which unfortunately instead was channeling millions of dollars to Hamas. Well, FBI and the Department of Justice caught up with them. The trial concluded in 2008 with a 108-count unanimous guilty verdict. All the leaders of that group are now in jail, and the group is shut down. But the important thing about the Holy Land Foundation trial is the evidence that was presented at the trial and then made public by the judge who decided it was so important that Americans needed to see it. And that evidence includes original documents of the Muslim Brotherhood in America. So how do we know they're here? Because they told us so. In their own documents, they told us so, and we have them, and they're public. I'll mention just one other of our little monographs from the Center for Security Policy, and it is one of those documents from the Holy Land Foundation trial that we sort of printed up in a paperback little pamphlet form. It's called the Explanatory Memorandum. And it is a 1991 document that reports on the status of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States at that time, reporting back from the U.S. to the mothership, if you will, back in Egypt. And very thoughtfully, the Muslim Brotherhood included at the last page of that document a whole page of its affiliates, 29 of them at that point. There are hundreds more now, but 29 of the major ones. And those major ones are still active and expanding to this day in the United States. So
that's nice of them to line that out for us so we know
Where to look. Yeah. Claire, we've got to take a really quick break, and then we will come back and finish out the hour with you. We are visiting with Claire Lopez. She's the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. You can find all of that on our website. It is wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelite, sir. Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir.
Well, there we go.
Circle back to the Israelites, because Bill did a little homework on the embassy situation.
Yeah, I answer my own question here. I asked you, Claire, who else was in Jerusalem, and it turns out that several countries, Belgium, France, Greece, the Holy See, Italy, Spain, Sweden, Turkey, and the United Kingdom all have what they refer to as diplomatic missions in Tel Aviv, and also have their embassies, diplomatic missions in Jerusalem. But their embassy, official embassy, is in Tel Aviv. So I just, I would imagine with this move with the United States, maybe they'll cut the game and just move there because they're already there. But I thought that was interesting.
Sometimes all it takes is a real leader. And,
exactly.
We have that now in our president, Donald Trump.
Yep. So someone's willing to step out. You know, I was in your extensive bio that we actually have corrected on the website this time.
Thank you.
We brought you into the present day. We'll stop spreading lies about the past. It says here that since 2013, you've been a member of the Citizens Commission on Benghazi.
Yeah, what's that? Is there anything ever going to come of that?
Anything about Benghazi in a long time.
Are they still looking into that?
Right. So this is a group founded by Roger Aronoff, who is a wonderful journalist, writer, author, had been with AIM, Accuracy in Media, at that time. And he brought together a bunch of us who were retired from, we have retired military officers, retired other from the media, some special forces, a couple of us. From the intelligence community, because in 2013, when we came together, the year after the attack on our mission in Benghazi, in which four Americans died and others were grievously injured, we were looking at the various congressional investigations then beginning or underway, and we didn't see them getting to the heart of the matter. We didn't see them for all the Sturm und Drang and all the you know, hearings and whatnot that were held, the State Department's own investigation, accountability, what did they call it, the accountability something. There was not the kind of attention to the detail we thought should have been highlighted, and so we formed this group. And we invited sources to come to us and talk to us, even if they had not talked to the media or to Congress before. And they did. People did come to us. And so we wrote two reports from that period forward. One came out in April of 2014. And the second, we called the first one, When America Switched Sides in the War on Terror, because that's what happened in Libya. The Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, State Department decided to help overthrow the leaders of countries across North Africa and the Middle East to help replace them with the Muslim Brotherhood. And The second paper, which came out in June of last year, 2016, is the more definitive and final report of our group, Citizens Commission on Benghazi, about what happened. Both of those can be found at the AIM website, so that would be www.aim.org, and you'll find a tab there that says Benghazi, and you'll find the reports there. The most important thing right now, and the reason that we're trying so hard to keep attention focused on Benghazi and keep this alive, is that the policy that drove the Obama administration, the Hillary Clinton State Department, to assist and support in the overthrow of governments from Ben Ali in Tunisia to Muammar Gaddafi in Libya to Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. They tried with Bashar al-Assad in Syria, but he had powerful allies in Iran and Hezbollah and Russia. Saleh, just recently killed, was ousted in Yemen. But focus on North Africa here. And that policy of the Barack Obama administration, as we understand it, was captured in a document called PSD-11, Presidential Security Directive-11, PSD-11. And that is a document that, as we understand it, was issued, promulgated in August of 2010 by the administration, but kept classified. It is still classified to this day, except that leaks about it have come out in the time since, and that's how we know or have at least some idea of what's in it. And basically it spells out the Obama administration's decision to empower the Muslim Brotherhood and to let the other governments across North Africa fall to uprisings, to armed uprisings, to revolutions. This was the Obama administration's policy. And in Libya, it was particularly detrimental to U.S. national security, never mind Libya's as well, because of our mission there, which was not a diplomatic mission. It wasn't official at all. It was a villa in a residential neighborhood of Benghazi, and it was just called the Special Mission Compound. And then, of course, there was a CIA base of operations or CIA annex some distance away. And these were the facilities that were attacked in September 2012. Why? Because the jihadis, Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood, in Libya, wanted Westerners out. They wanted us out of all of North Africa, but certainly out of Libya. And with American help and NATO help, too, bombing during the 2011 uprising, they had gotten rid of Gaddafi. And many other missions had left the country, the British, the French, the Italians, Red Cross, etc., all pulled out. We were left. The Americans were left. But because Hillary Clinton and the State Department did not want to call attention to the disaster that Libya had become after her policies and Obama's ousted and murdered Muammar Gaddafi, who had been helping us against al-Qaeda before that in what used to be called the Global War on Terrorism, because they didn't want to call attention to the failed state that Libya was becoming with al-Qaeda and other jihadi militias running amok around the place, they refused all requests for security for our mission in Benghazi. That's why they were so vulnerable when they got attacked the night of the night of September 11, 12 in 2012. And
but that
I will mention an event that I just took part in, an annual event, held by a wonderful citizen group in Jacksonville, Florida, called the Benghazi Tribute. And they hold it every year with a local color guard and Boy Scouts and a flag ceremony and a wreath ceremony to commemorate our four fallen, Ambassador Chris Stevens and Sean Smith, the two security, former SEAL, security personnel, Ty Woods and Glenn Doherty. And then they invite some of us from the Citizens Commission to speak, and also this year they had Dinesh D'Souza there just a week ago, or a little more, who gave a wonderful speech. So this is what it's about. And we're calling especially on the Trump administration now, to make public PSD 11, Presidential Security Directive 11. It is obviously a failed policy, even a treasonous policy, and it is time that the Trump administration made that public, showed the American people what the Barack Obama administration and Hillary Clinton State Department did in our name with our taxpayer money that led to the murder of these four Americans.
And do you think if they make that document public, it will give a clearer explanation as to why they withheld support after the attacks started? And from everything I've read, they had plenty of time to get some support in there.
Yes, they did. They absolutely did.
And they failed to do that. Okay, good.
But more to the point, by revealing what was done, it sets the stage for a change in policy. And obviously the Trump administration policy is going to be much different than that of his predecessor, and certainly there across North Africa. But it would help to begin a policy of openly taking on the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a jihadist organization dedicated to the overthrow of every government in the world that is not Sharia adherent, the establishment of a global caliphate under rule of Sharia, of Islamic law. And they operate in the Middle East. They operate here inside the United States. And what we would like to see the Trump administration do is call them out for what they are, a jihadist organization in the United States, subversive, not terrorist, but subversive, which is way worse than mere violence, and highlight a change in policy. Mark a distinct turn away from the policy of his predecessor and towards his own policy. That's what we're hoping for.
Well, we're watching, and so for the people who don't know you, you were also a career operations officer with the CIA. So,
yes.
So it's not like you just read about this in a book and you're kind of making it up. I mean,
I was not involved in anything in the Middle East or to do with these kinds of issues back then. I was focused on Soviet Union and Russia during my career.
Oh, sure.
But what that experience does do is gives me some knowledgeability about the world, the players in it,
and how the inside of the government reporting and information. Yeah,
that we used, you know, those skills during we the Citizens Commission used those skills during our. Investigation of the Benghazi massacre.
Well, since you have worked inside that system, I mean, from the outside looking in, it looks like a lot of this is just hugely corrupt. I mean, you have all these people who were actually on Hillary's campaign and all these different things, FBI most specifically. From your vantage point, what do you think's going on in there?
Well, I would point your attention and your listeners' attention to some outstanding investigative journalists who are putting this in front of us, the facts in front of us. Sarah Carter, for one, writing for Circa. John Solomon, another. Both of them frequent guests on the Sean Hannity show at Fox. These are up right out in front in exposing. And then I have to give a tip of the hat to Judicial Watch under the leadership of Tom Fitton and his team Chris Farrell and others, who are doing such dogged, fantastic work in prying information out of a government that even now does not want to relinquish it. So watch those various places for reporting on what's going on. It seems, you know, in Sean Hannity's words, TikTok, it's something every day.
Unbelievable. I guess that's what we're looking at, is just the unbelievable drip, drip, drip of this. And I just wondered from, you know, where you've been, what this looks like. We have to take one more really quick break, and then we'll be back with Claire. And she has to depart at the top of the hour because she has stuff to do. So we won't fool around at all. We'll get right to it here. Be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Bull is loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war. But what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. I can see me in a long row, studying the book of Job, and walking to Jerusalem, marching with Methuselah. By the time you tell me I'm the one, I'll be sticking out my thumb and walking.
Who says country music isn't educational?
That's right.
All right. You're in the know. We're back here with our guest, Claire Lopez. Okay, so Claire, I know we're veering wildly from one thing to the next, but in your accurate bio that we have posted on our website, it says here that you are a member of the Congressional Task Force on National and Homeland Security, focusing on the electromagnetic pulse threat to the nation.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Is
so
that
what's up with that?
With all this North Korea stuff, I mean, is
where are we with that?
Yeah, what's happening there?
Right. So EMP, for your listeners, is electromagnetic pulse. It's a phenomenon that can be unleashed by a nuclear weapon detonated in the high atmosphere, 30 to 400 kilometers up, or it can also be generated by the sun, which gives off solar flares all the time, but those don't always hit us. But the effect is a stream of supercharged gamma rays that course down through our atmosphere, and because the U.S. civilian electric grid is completely unsecured, unprotected against these effects. If this were to happen, either from the sun or a hostile enemy detonating a nuclear weapon above us, our electric grid would crash. It would go down. It would cascade in a series of failures across the country, and we would not have electricity anymore.
Oh,
we
nice.
Would not be able to get it started again.
Yeah, because I understand that some of these big power plants run generation systems that will take years to rebuild and put back online, because we don't have backups. Like, we can't just run over and plug in a new one. We don't have any. Is that the case?
It is the case. The great big substations that anchor our electric grid. There are actually three grids, an eastern one, a western one, and the Texas one, that anchor that and cobble it together. And by the way, we're connected to Canada, too, so they really couldn't help us because they'd go down, too. Now, think of what life would be like without electricity. We are an electric society. Everything that we have, from food to water to delivery of fuel and gasoline, banking and financial services, hospital emergency services, vehicles, you name it, telecommunications for sure, no TV, no internet, no telephones, all of that would go down, and we could not get it back because our Congress has refused for years upon years to pass legislation that would actually mandate the unfederally or federally unregulated power and power industries in the United States mandate them to implement the protections with the grid that would protect us. So there's failure on the part of the power industry, and there was failure on the part of Congress to pass laws that would require the protection of our grid. Individual citizens, if you're listening, what you can do is go to your phones, your emails, your Twitter, your whatever it is, and bombard your representatives in Congress with messages about the electric grid. And by the way, the other thing that just happened, Congress just disbanded the EMP Commission, which had functioned under congressional supervision for the last decade.
Why would they do that?
That makes no sense.
They felt like it. There's no reason.
What committee is this? It isn't Congress as a whole, right?
No, it's a commission. It was a commission authorized by Congress.
Right.
Now disbanded. There isn't any. There is no law passed. So we the people out here dependent on electricity.
We're sitting ducks.
Are sitting ducks. Now, I mean, think of what happens during a hurricane or even a, you know, an ordinary, super summer storm or let's say even a winter storm. It gets pretty tough after just a few days.
Sure.
With electricity down. Most people don't have stockpiles of food and water to last more than a few days. Congress itself, over the last decade or more, has produced a number of studies, quite a number of studies, about the EMP danger, and concluded that if we lose the electricity and we cannot get it back, that in a year, 9 out of 10 Americans would be dead of starvation and lack of medical care and societal collapse.
Right.
Now, I'll add to the pre-Christmas cheer here, I suppose.
I was going to say, we've taken a dark turn.
Yeah, and that is...
Who would have thought it could
that,
be worse in the Middle East? Huh.
You mentioned North Korea and Iran, and yes, North Korea definitely has the capability to reach the United States with its ballistic missiles. Those ballistic missiles could be tipped with any kind of a warhead. We know that the North Koreans have tested nuclear warheads. We also know that, by the way, the North Koreans have 2 satellites orbiting above North America, the Western Hemisphere, altogether. And we don't know what's in the satellites. One went up in 2012. One went up there in 2016. They circle above the United States every single day, and we don't know what's in them.
Mm.
If they were to hold one or the other, an EMP, that could be detonated remotely by radio signal from the Earth. Just to mention it. Everything that North Korea has in terms of this kind of weaponry, ballistic missiles, nuclear warheads, miniaturized nuclear warheads that fit on the nose cone of the ballistic missiles, Iran does too.
Now, are those miniature warheads... Are they large enough to create an EMP that would do this kind of damage?
Well, the thing about an EMP, and in particular something called a super EMP, is that the size of the nuclear warhead in kiloton size can be quite small. I mean,
right.
Less than 10 kilotons, 1 to 3 kilotons even. It's not about the size of the explosive blast, you see, but rather the ability to generate that gamma ray flow that I mentioned earlier, that's where the effect of the EMP comes from.
And then that creates the cascade effect that just goes
if
through the whole system.
It falls into our unprotected electric grid, yes.
Okay. All right. Wow. So I guess our concern about North Korea is well founded. When this guy throws these things up in the air and has the range they have, I mean that's a real threat.
Claire, who's heading up the committee, or what committee is it that deals with this? I mean, I know
there isn't one anymore. None. There isn't any.
But doesn't it fall under someone's committee? Is it?
I mean, we would like it to.
Is it water and power, or who?
No. Nobody focuses on this anymore at all. Nobody. There's nobody in Congress right now. Listen to this. Nobody in Congress right now, no committee chairman, is dedicated to the EMP threat from the sun or from our adversaries or the measures necessary to secure the U.S. grid. Nobody in Congress. Nobody.
Holy cow. So if something was on the horizon, we got nobody to go to.
We can't even scramble.
Yeah, we can't even say, hey, get them on the phone.
Go to your own local representative, whether they're on such a committee or not, never mind. but go to them and express your dismay at what you've heard today about this. Mm-hmm. And what needs to happen is that a committee, which you would think would have oversight over this, like national homeland security committee,
sure.
Or something like that, that they would reestablish an EMP commission under congressional leadership, and then get to this legislation. Get to legislation that will mandate the power and utility industries to secure the grid.
Yeah, and for those folks out there that are thinking, well, you know what, I live in an area where, you know, I'm isolated. I have a generator, and I'll be okay if that happens. You won't be okay, because if this happens, what you just said about the banking, the fuel, the food, all that stops flowing.
It's a cascading.
And these people that don't have a generator or are starving out there, they're going to come and take yours. And that's going to be the way things are for a long time. So
well, just out of curiosity,
problem.
Claire, when you guys were looking at this, what did you recommend they do?
We recommended Congress listen to the then still existing EMP commission under the leadership of Peter Pry, William Graham, other experts like that. We recommended that they pass the legislation that would mandate the protection, the securing of the U.S. grid. And by the way, don't be thinking it's some hugely super expensive undertaking. I mean, for a couple of $100 million, the basics can be done. The basics can be accomplished to at least put into effect the most critical, necessary protections, and then we can build out from there. That's, you know, pocket change for...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
no
stop
kidding.
The cascade effect. At least, you know, we wouldn't lose it for the entire country.
Well, this
We'd
is what we want them
to
do.
On.
Reestablish the EMP Commission in Congress. Refocus on legislation that would require the power and utilities industries to secure the grid. Bring back the experts like Peter Pry, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and Dr. William Graham for advice on what needs to be done. They know. They've worked on this for decades.
Thank you so much. We will definitely send that out.
And we need to do it again. We'll pick a day when we can get you for a full 2 hours, because I've just got so many more.
Or we'll just talk about 2 hours, and then we'll just make it an hour at the last minute. Hey, thank you so much.
Thank you both for having me.
We've had a great time and learned a lot. That's been Claire Lopez with the Center for Security Policy.org is their website. You can find all of that on our site at WeThePeopleRadio.us.